This is William and Lonsdale, a podcast about the legal ecosystem and the fascinating people who make it tick. Today, your host, Michael Green, speaks with forensic and child psychiatrist, Dr. Adam Deacon. When Adam was in medical school, he thought sports medicine would be his specialty. But as his rotations exposed him to the various disciplines within medicine, it was both pediatrics and psychiatry that captured his interest. And ultimately, he became the first person in Australia and New Zealand to qualify as both a forensic and child psychiatrist. And he has brought this combination to bear in his career and work within the criminal justice system. Yet on reflection, Adam can see that the very first seed for his career trajectory was planted way back in primary school, when he realised not everyone grew up in the kind of home he did.
I guess one of the central influences for me to perhaps pursue psychiatry, which wasn't apparent at the time, was when I was a kid. And as I said, that I was raised in a comfortable environment. As a kid, I think I was one of those kids who was observant and sort of wondered what was going on with kids, what drove kids. And I had this experience with a friend where I visited his home and had a sleepover. And it was immediately apparent that his home was very different to mine. I mean, it was quite an awakening and nothing bad happened. It was simply the environment and the relations that he had with his parents and caregivers that drew attention to that point of difference and some level of disadvantage that he was subject to. And this is a kid who was a lovely kid, but he had some problems. And as a young kid, when I was 7 or 8, I didn't know or understand what those problems were or what the origins may have been. But when I visited him and observed the interactions he had with particularly his father, who was quite an intimidating presence and certainly not nurturing, and I observed his anxiety and then I felt his anxiety, and in the sleepover I didn't sleep. And that sat with me and probably still does. And I think in many ways probably was one of the critical moments in my life that enlightened me to the point of difference that we all come from different backgrounds, different lives. But those who come from more disadvantaged backgrounds, there's a raft of consequences of that. And I think that really pushed me towards doing this sort of work.
Our guest this morning on Lions in the Law is Adam Deacon. Adam's a bit different in that he's not a lawyer, but I'll let him tell his story about how he has a life in the law. And I should also say that I'm labouring under a cold this morning, and so if I sound a bit different to our regular listeners, that'll be the reason why. Adam, good morning and thanks for coming in.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So you're not a lawyer, but you do have a significant professional life in the law. Explain it to us. What do you do?
So my title, I guess, is a forensic psychiatrist, and more specifically a child and youth forensic psychiatrist, although I do work in the adult sector as well. So my current role is predominantly with a service at Alfred Health, the Youth Forensic Specialist Service, which is a consultation service for young people who are displaying behaviours of concern or are intersecting with the justice system. But I also work in private practice where, as a forensic psychiatrist, I'm predominantly acting as an expert either for the prosecution or defence and providing assessments and reports.
And so your practice is entirely forensic. You don't do any clinical practice on behalf of general members of the community?
No, I do. Yeah, so I work a day a week in private practice, which is partly forensic work, doing reports, but I do have a reasonably large number of clinical patients who I see on a varying basis, so up to weekly. Some of those have been young people who I've followed through for many years. Some of them are adults. There's a few elderly patients, and there's a subgroup of athletes. So I've sort of carved out a little bit of a niche in sports psychiatry. So I deal specifically with the mental health of athletes.
Okay, well, let's go back to the start, as we always do. Where did you grow up? What was your family like? And how did you finish up being a medico?
So I was raised in Mount Waverley, so one of three boys, middle child. So Mount Waverley was a very sort of middle-class suburb. Attended the local primary school, Essex Heights Primary School there. It's interesting sort of having spent so much time speaking to people about their lives, when I reflect on my childhood, I'd say it was pretty normal. There was nothing sort of extraordinary. I was well cared for. It was a sort of secure home that I lived in. I sort of had lots of opportunities to do good things, but it wasn't extravagant. I was sort of well nurtured and guided, I guess. When I reflect on my childhood, it's generally very positive.
Education?
So I attended Essex Heights Primary, then I attended Wesley College for 2 years in Glen Waverley, and then moved to Melbourne High School. So Melbourne High only caters to kids from year 9 to 12. So that's where I completed my education before going on to Melbourne University.
Melbourne High is a scholarship school. You have to actually sit an exam to get in there?
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's a scholarship per se, but there's an entrance exam. So there's a process of a lot of candidates applying, and then a proportion of those are allocated to sit the exam, and then a small number get through. So I think there was about 300 or 330 students who found a spot at the school.
And so to round out the picture, what about sport? What part did sport play in your life?
It's been very central to my life and continues to. I've always loved sport, was drawn to it from a very young age. You know, as one of those young kids, I think one of my earliest memories is really watching the Olympic Games as a sort of 4 or 5 year old and being quite absorbed by that and captured by it. AFL football's been very central as well, as it is for many people in Melbourne. But I guess as a kid, I sort of dabbled in everything and was given those opportunities. I wasn't extraordinarily good at anything, but I enjoyed it a lot and experimented with lots of different sports through my life, yeah.
Okay, so you get through school, you come from a supportive family. You start med at Melbourne Uni 1989.
That's correct, yeah.
Did you enjoy medicine? Was it as someone who was at Melbourne Uni at least 20 years, 25 years before you, the medical students to me always seem to work bloody hard.
Yeah, look, it is arduous. I mean, I think my first response is yes, I did enjoy it. I mean, it's a unique experience. I think it's a privilege really to be able to be given a medical education. And I guess over time I've sort of been grateful to be given the opportunity to learn really, and medicine just gives you this sort of endless opportunity to keep learning. So from that perspective, yes, it's onerous. It's quite demanding. There's lots of exams and it goes on for a long time. I wasn't an exceptional student. I was sort of mid-range certainly in the early years. I sort of improved as I went on. But on the whole, yes, and a lot of good relationships you form. Obviously, and yeah, again, it's a privilege. There's a lot of sort of unique opportunities and experiences you have through your medical education.
You didn't scoot through medicine in the obligatory 6 years, or as it used to be 6 years. You took a couple of years off.
Yeah, I did. I took a year off after third year to explore other opportunities, particularly in sport. So I had this sort of burning desire at a fairly young age to see whether I could qualify to do the Hawaii Ironman triathlon. And that was just something that, again, captured me as a young kid watching wild water sport. So that was always in the back of my mind as something I aspired to do. And I knew I couldn't really do that or prepare for that whilst I was studying as hard as I was. So I took some time off and I did other studies, but I didn't do medicine for that year. And I did something similar later on as well. So it's sort of something I've always come back to.
The other studies were medical science, I think.
It was called a Bachelor of Medical Science. So it was it's a research year. So I took a year off, and at that stage I was very keen to pursue a career potentially in sports medicine. That was sort of what sort of grabbed me. And so I took a year off and worked at the Olympic Park Sports Medicine Centre and studied the knee joint of retired AFL footballers. So it was the first study of its type looking at the prevalence of osteoarthritis in retired footballers, and no surprise that they had a higher prevalence compared to another cohort who hadn't played football. So that's what I did for that year.
Can I just go back to the Ironman just to make sure everybody understands? My recollection is the Hawaiian Ironman is a marathon.
That's the end. Yeah, that's the third leg.
42 Ks.
Yeah.
100 Ks on a bike or further?
180.
180 yeah. Ks on a bike. And how long's the swim?
3.8.
And so that took a lot of training.
Yeah, it does. It's sort of something that you can't just turn your mind to and think you're going to race the next day. There's a lot of preparation. And sort of from a physical maturation point of view, it takes a lot of time for your body to be able to recover from the training. So I was quite young. I was only 20 when I did my first Ironman. But yeah, but it takes an enormous amount of application and time, similar to medicine in many ways. So I sort of moved from one thing that was absorbing me to another, really.
So you come back, and at some stage you do rotations in a medical degree, I understand, and you do paediatrics, obstetrics, gynaecology, psychiatry, and whatever else. Why did you get a desire, a wish, an inclination to do psychiatry across or above the other areas?
Yeah, look, there was a particular experience, I think, that sort of steered me, and there's sort of, when I reflect backwards, there's other things probably in my childhood that probably influenced it or shaped it as well. But in my psychiatry rotation, we had a couple of days where we visited the forensic hospital. It was called Mont Park at the time. There was a psychiatrist there, Dr. Ruth Vine, who went on to become the chief psychiatrist in Victoria. But she was, I guess, an inspiration in many ways, simply from the fact that I sat with her while she was interviewing a patient whom had been found not guilty on the grounds of mental impairment. And it was a very serious offence. It was a case of a murder of a family member. And And I was sort of struck by that. I was more struck by her compassion for the patient and how she put that person at ease, and they were grieving in a complex way with regards to what they'd committed, and also working through their mental illness, and that person was going to be in hospital for a long period of time. And I guess I was just confronted by that, but also inspired by a psychiatrist who was able to be remarkably empathetic with a tragedy, really. And that sort of struck a chord with me, I guess, and that came back to be sort of my inspiration, I think, later on to pursue a career in forensic psychiatry.
Adam, with three or four Ironmans thrown in, you finish your medical degree in 8 years, and then you start down the path of qualifying as a psychiatrist. What does that entail?
So once you graduate with the MBS, you have to do an internship year, which is a general medical, surgical and other subspecialties. And that's followed by usually one or two medical officer years, again, where you're getting more broad experience in a range of different medical fields. And during that process, I had and deliberately did seek some opportunities to do psychiatry to sort of see whether that consolidated my interest. And then it's a process of applying for the program. It's a five-year program to qualify.
Sorry, can I just clarify there? Who runs this program? It's not the university.
No, it's the Royal Australian and New Zealand College of Psychiatry. Yeah, they've got the oversight, and there's a whole lot of requirements that you have to meet. It's quite stringent. There's examinations, there's oral examinations, written examinations. There's a range of different requirements that you need to fulfil throughout that five-year period.
And so you go through all of that five-year period, do you qualify at the end as a forensic psychiatrist and a child psychiatrist?
No, that qualifies you as a generalist, a general psychiatrist. Having said that, the last 2 years of the 5 years, you can select a subspecialty if you wish, and I chose forensic psychiatry, but in the back of my mind, I also realised I wanted to do child and adolescent psychiatry, and that was a challenge because at that stage, and still to this day, in fact, there's not a program that caters to blending those two facets together. So I did both sort of in parallel. I started sort of more with forensics and then sort of added in child and adolescent and managed to complete them over about sort of 3.5 years rather than the full four. So that stretched my training out another couple of years.
Okay, so you qualify, you become a member or fellow of the society, I guess.
Fellow of the college, yeah.
Fellow of the college, sorry. And you qualified as a forensic psychiatrist. What do you do? I mean, I guess doctors, GPs, aren't referring criminals to you for psychiatric treatment or support. How does it work for a forensic psychiatrist?
Yeah, so I guess it's best worth going back a little bit to the training program. So the two-year training program gives you an opportunity to dabble in different areas. So I did some work at the Thomas Embling Hospital, the forensic hospital, the secure hospital in Melbourne. I worked in prisons and a range of prisons, women's and men's prisons. And also doing community forensic work where you're doing a range of different work with people with varying problem behaviours and doing court reports and so forth. So it's quite broad. I needed to do that to get my forensic certificate. And then once I was a forensic psychiatrist by title, then there's a bit more liberty to choose sort of the different areas you might want to work in. And I worked partly in the community role, and also I worked down at Bowen Prison where I stayed for about 6 years. And that was an interesting decision in hindsight in some ways. I sort of threw myself into in an environment that I was trained to manage, but it was on reflection a very onerous experience over that duration and during an era that was very, very challenging in a prison setting.
So in the prison setting, are you doing clinical work with inmates?
That's correct, yes. So my job primarily there is I work pretty much hand in hand with the psychiatric nurse who will receive referrals, whether that's through corrections officers or the prisoners themselves or the hospital doctor, seeking assessments and management of prisoners. So that's clinical work. It's not doing forensic reporting, whereas the work I might have been doing in the community may have been referrals from the court to examine an individual in regards to their offending and the nexus with their mental health issues.
So you may get a referral from the court or a referral from the accused person's lawyers acting on behalf of the accused. You may get a referral from the prosecution.
Yes.
It's all of those?
Yeah, all three. And I guess it depends on what role you're in. So in a private role, I predominantly am doing defence work. So defence lawyers will refer. But on occasion, the Office of Public Prosecutions will as well. They'll seek out private experts. And then when I was working with forensic care, it will be court-ordered reports and also through the OPP, but not through the defence.
Did you find that or do you find that work satisfying?
Yeah, look, I always find it intriguing. I still don't think there's necessarily a case that comes across my desk that my initial response is one of interest and intrigue. Some are obviously far more interesting than others, but nothing's the same. I mean, I guess that's one thing I've sort of still inspired to keep doing the work, is that no case is the same, and the endless sort of intriguing stories that you come across still sort of excites me in some way. So from that perspective, my interest has never waned, really. Yes, there's some cases that are a little bit more mundane than others, but on the whole, no, I sort of maintain my curiosity and interest.
The prosecution and the defence are seeking to achieve different ends.
Yes.
How does that affect you when they come to you and say, could you please provide us with a report? Defence are trying to establish a defence, and hopefully your report will provide them with that defence or a part of that defence, whereas the prosecution, although they shouldn't be seeking a conviction, they are seeking to lay before the court the whole truth of the matter. Is there a difference in what is expected of you?
There's sort of a yes and no answer to that. The no answer is that my duty is to the court to be the independent expert and be completely objective and impartial. But your point is a correct one, that the referral comes from two different angles potentially, and what is being sought may have a declared or sort of subtle bias that might be sort of pushing you or directing you in a particular direction. And I think it's just important that you need to acknowledge that that is a differential, and you have to manage it as best you can, that you're not being swayed or pushed in a different direction. You have to be independent. And I guess the more experience you get, the sharper you are in terms of how you sort of respond in that way. But it's no point in denying that when you're doing defence work or work for the prosecution, it can feel like you're being nudged in a certain direction at the start. You just got to sort of acknowledge that and do your best in terms of steering somewhere in the middle.
Could a situation arise where you've been asked to do something, in doing it, it raises with you something important which maybe is not apparent to the people instructing you?
That sort of thing can happen, yeah. I mean, I guess those sorts of things arise, and your obligation is to report back what's been shared with you. That's your duty, and that's explained to the client in advance that there's not confidentiality. And then the report is tendered, and then what happens with that report is up to the defence and prosecution as to whether they submit them or otherwise, and whether you might be cross-examined. So I guess one of the challenges in the work sometimes is that you provide reports and you never find out what the outcomes are. Unless you're cross-examined, then you might get a bit more information about it.
What about when you are cross-examined? Now, I must say, I once, a long time ago as a young lawyer, gave evidence and was cross-examined and found it pretty stressful. What's it like being a professional witness, an expert, being cross-examined? I mean, typically barristers, not typically, but often, they can be aggressive in their cross-examination. How does it affect you?
Yeah, I guess it comes back to the training again. So part of the training is to be supervised and supported through the process of potentially being cross-examined and sort of what are the things that you can anticipate and how you can prepare yourself most effectively. I was certainly more daunted when I started getting cross-examined than I am now. I actually don't mind it. In fact, sometimes I not so much enjoy it, but I benefit from it because I think the questions that barristers ask are really relevant and it helps you with other examinations you do in the future. So I've always sort of taken it from that perspective that I learn something from it every time. And at the end of the day, if your report is sound and you can back up everything you've written, then there's no need to be particularly anxious about things. Yes, there's curly questions, no doubt, but I guess with more experience, you feel a bit more confident in how to respond, or if you can respond. You can't always respond, of course.
Do you need to have some level of legal knowledge to provide the service you provide and to do the work you do?
Not specifically. I mean, I guess our training familiarises ourselves with legal process. It's an option whether you want to go and do further studies, and there are courses that you can do which are medical law, which I haven't done and some of my colleagues have, and there might be some advantages in doing that, but not necessarily that you're attuned to all the sort of subtleties of legal practice. But I guess in the space that we work in, we become far more astute in terms of what's being asked of us and what's required and the sort of legal boundaries that we need to sort of be cognizant of. So it's just through learning and exposure, really, rather than formal teaching.
You've explained to us in preparation for this morning, there are two types of reports you provide, an evidentiary report and a pre-sentence report. Can you just explain to us what they are and what the purpose of them is?
Yeah, so the evidentiary reports are of two forms. There's a request to consider whether there can be support for a mental impairment defence, which is a legal construct that a person can be deemed to be mentally impaired, so they've got a form of mental illness and they meet particular criteria under the Mental Impairment Act, which refers to their knowledge of what they're doing and also further whether they understood what they were doing was wrong. And there's other sort of legal words that support that. And then the second type of evidentiary report, which often goes hand in hand, is a fitness report, a fitness to stand trial report. So there's particular criteria that we as experts need to consider in providing an assessment and an opinion about whether a person can be deemed fit to stand trial.
Fitness to stand trial, Adam, doesn't seem to me to come up very often, but it may come up more often than I'm aware. And of course, because it may be that it's found that the person is not fit to stand trial and therefore we don't hear about it. How often does it come up? Is it a regular thing?
Well, it is not irregular. It is regular for me. I'm not sure where it lies sort of relative to all the cases that go through. So it's probably relatively uncommon, but I get requests to do fitness and mental impairment cases quite frequently. In fact, I'd be guessing, but I probably provide opinions and evidentiary reports maybe 20 or 30 times a year, maybe more. And some of those are young people and some of them are adults. So I guess it's not that infrequent, but yeah, you probably don't hear about it. And I guess people sometimes are found to be unfit, but part of the legislation is to determine whether the person can become fit. And the cases that I predominantly see are people with mental illness that we give them an opportunity to recover from their illness so they become fit and have that opportunity to enter a plea. So, yeah, so it comes across my desk quite frequently, probably more mental impairment requests than fitness requests, though.
Mm-hmm. And what about pre-sentencing? What does that entail?
So that's post-plea. So a person's entered a plea and the request is to provide an opinion that mostly relates to the nexus between the identified mental illness and the offence itself, if there is one. And so that's the duty of the psychiatrist to sort of provide a detailed synopsis of the person's background history, their psychiatric history, and then linking that in where, if relevant, with the offence itself. And then that will help guide the magistrate or judge in determining what would be an appropriate sentence. There's a number of criteria they will need to adhere to. So that's one element. And then there's also the element of making comment where one can about the prospect of that person being impacted by a custodial sentence by virtue that they've got a mental health problem. And will that deteriorate or will that be exacerbated in a custodial setting?
Adam, I assume most people are drawn to be doctors because they are empathetic, compassionate people and therefore have sympathy for people who have had difficult lives and have had situations beyond their control. If my assumption's correct, is it difficult to remain impartial as a psychiatrist giving evidence to help a court make a decision?
Look, absolutely. As a generalisation, yeah, I think there is certainly a bias towards people who pursue the medical profession to have some level of innate compassion and empathy. And if you don't have that, you're probably going to struggle to perform. As a psychiatrist, it's the same. And in fact, I would argue it's even stronger that the stories are inevitably emotionally laden and your empathy is evoked very, very readily. And I find that particularly with young people, more so perhaps than adults. But I think it's just registering that, acknowledging that there's things that are going to be triggered within you, but you've got to come back to what your job is and what your task is. And if it is that you're the independent expert, that's your job and you need to sort of try to disassociate as best you can. But you can still express empathy within certain boundaries. I think that's important, in fact, in doing a forensic assessment, that you don't have to be a robot and sort of devoid yourself of emotion, but you need to put limits on that at the same time. So again, I think it's just something that you become more equipped with, more attuned to, and you're able to exercise that more effectively the more experience you have.
This is maybe it's pie in the sky asking this question, but from your experience, could you estimate what percentage of people who are convicted of a crime or come before the courts have significant mental health problems? Is it very common?
Yes, it is, and it's even more common in youth, and that's where I've predominantly worked, and there's very sound literature looking at this in the youth sector in particular, but there's a very high prevalence of mental disorder in youth and to some degree equivalence in adults as well. I guess it depends on what we're describing in terms of pathology or mental disorder, but many people will have histories that predispose them to a range of mental health problems by virtue that they've come from very disadvantaged backgrounds, and we know that in itself are significant risk factors. So many will have identifiable mental health problems and many very serious ones as well. So there's a much greater prevalence, for example, of psychotic disorders in the prison system. It's about 10%, whereas in the community it might be about 1%. It's a significant difference and even greater in young people.
And does our criminal justice system properly deal with these greater prevalence of mental health issues among offenders?
It's a difficult question to answer. We certainly try to, and there's certainly services that endeavour to cater to the needs, and there's very complex needs here. I guess it depends on the setting. So if we're talking custodial settings, by virtue that they are these very restrictive, austere settings that arguably are non-therapeutic, we're trying to provide a therapeutic response to people with complex needs whilst they're locked away and sometimes for 23 hours a day. So you could put a strong argument that that really doesn't really cater to the therapeutic needs of an individual, but it doesn't mean we can't provide a service and can't provide some level of care. But that's one of the real challenges, I think, working in prison settings, that it's a vexed issue, I think, for psychiatrists or for medical professionals more broadly, is that you're there to provide a health service in an environment that arguably is not conducive to providing that.
And so that being the case, why did you go and work down at Bowen Prison for 6 years?
I was asked to initially, and I perhaps a bit naively agreed to it. But look, it was actually a really valuable experience because I guess in psychiatry, it's when you sort of see the more extremities of things that you can have a little bit more insight into the things that are a bit more moderate. And so I saw sort of all the extremities down in Bowen. So from a sort of an enriching experience and a learning experience, it was invaluable, but incredibly challenging and very stressful at times. And there was some, a number of significant incidents that occurred down there when I was there, and they do have some level of a scarring effect. So that's one of the difficulties, I suppose, working in those environments. It's probably everyone's got a time limit to how much time they could or should spend in those environments.
William and Lonsdale is brought to you by Greens List, one of the leading multidisciplinary barristers' lists in Australia. Greens List believe in promoting conversation around the ideas and issues that shape not only our legal system, but our wider community.
We no longer have mental health institutions in Victoria. They were done away with by a previous government. Does that impact upon our criminal justice system, Adam? And if so, how?
Oh, there's certainly strong evidence that it has had its impact, and it's sort of a trickling effect over time. But in fact, it reminds me when I did my psychiatry training, when it was at Mont Park and Larundel where those institutions existed. And whilst they were really impoverished sort of settings in some respects, they actually provided a great deal of support and care and 24-hour care for people who needed it. With deinstitutionalisation, many of those people fell between the cracks subsequently because we didn't have the community services to replace that. And so many of those people over time found themselves intersecting with the justice system, and many find themselves in prison. And to this day, that's still the case, is that there's a lot of a revolving door of people moving between community and prison because we just don't have the environments and the settings and the support that people require. There is some equivalence. I mean, there are some clinical services that provide some enduring care, but they're all finite. It's not a place where a person can live. And I guess that's one of the big gaps, is we don't really have something a step down from institutionalisation that may not have the stigma attached to it, but something that provides the necessary care.
You have said that we need a more wraparound and coordinated approach for this care for people.
Absolutely. And I guess it's this intersection between the community and people who come into the justice system. And there's certainly a lot of endeavours and good people working very hard to try and link people who are vulnerable, who find themselves in the justice system, so they are supported in the community. But, there's many who slip between the cracks. That homelessness is a massive issue, that many prisoners will exit the prison system and we don't have accommodation established for them on an enduring basis. They may have temporary accommodation or hotels and stuff, but that eventually they fall out and they're on the streets, and then drugs and other behaviours start manifesting, and before they know it, they're back in. And I've seen many, many, many cases of that. And that's very, very sad, I think, that there's many people who could be protected from the justice system if we provided just sort of social supports. Some people are afforded that, but many don't.
Adam, you may not have said explicitly, but you have certainly implied that working in the prison system had an impact upon you, and possibly not a desirable impact. A, was that the case? And B, what about other people who work in the prison system in particular and the criminal justice system in general, such as police officers, prison officers, judges and lawyers? Do you think it has an adverse effect upon them? And did it have an adverse effect upon you?
It certainly can, and it certainly did to some extent. It's only on reflection, really, that I can see the sort of insidious nature of those environments and how they can sort of have a psychological or emotional impact. And it probably was only after a few years that I sensed that I wasn't feeling the same. And feeling is a very, very broadly that I wasn't as comfortable or as enthused to attend. I didn't feel as secure and safe whilst I was there. I felt that I was becoming more cynical, and that was uncomfortable for me. So there was sort of some subtle effects, but over time, yeah, my enthusiasm was waning. I just didn't have the energy that I went in with, and I guess I paid attention to that. And there were some critical incidences that I won't go into, but some of those, to an extent, you do experience varying degrees of vicarious trauma, that you're aware of circumstances and things that have happened. And I think that's the nature of the work more broadly. You're hearing people's stories in depth, and that's your job to examine that. And so you need to protect yourself to some degree from the effects of that. And that's very, very difficult to do. And I, as a psychiatrist, I'm assuming it's a parallel experience for people, as you've mentioned, whether it's police or custodial staff or lawyers themselves, that there can be significant impacts, but we may not be very good at detecting those early as we need to.
As well as working at Barwon Prison with adult prisoners, you worked in youth justice institutions as well, which uses both parts of your specialty. Malmesbury, one in Tasmania called Ashley, Parkville. So you've got a great experience of an overview of our criminal justice system from the point of view of young offenders. Do we cater for young offenders appropriately as a community with these institutions?
It's a difficult question to answer. I think I'll start with things are getting better rather than getting worse, but things went backwards, I think, before they've come better. So I worked at Malmesbury and Parkville for many years, and recently, as early as next week, I think they're opening up Cherry Creek as a brand new facility, and that gives great opportunity, I think, for providing much more appropriately serviced rehabilitative services for young people. But youth justice facilities should be rehabilitative facilities, you know, places where kids get education and they are given opportunities to develop themselves and mitigate the behaviours that have led them to come into the justice system. I think what's occurred, not just in Victoria, but arguably across Australia, is that there's been this sort of creep from youth justice facilities being rehabilitative to being more prison-like. And some facilities, they're almost not discernible from a prison in many regards, in terms of the security that's there, that the environment itself feels very prison-like. And that's really, really critical, that how does a person feel in their environment? And if it feels like a prison, it acts like a prison, and people start behaving like they're prison guards rather than necessarily people who need to be supporting the young people. So that's something that's turning around, thankfully, and there's great prospects, I think, in Victoria now that we can improve the services catering to the young people. But, you know, until that's in evidence, there's still risks, I think, as you're highlighting, that kids who are in these institutions can deteriorate, that they're surrounded by kids of a similar nature with similar backgrounds, with similar offending profiles, and they learn from each other. And that's not good. So we need to sort of shield them from each other in some respects and give them other opportunities to develop positively.
Adam, very interestingly, you mentioned a place called Cherry Creek, which you said is opening next week. What's Cherry Creek?
So it's a new facility built down near Lara, and I think it's a $400+ million facility that's been designed to cater to the needs of, or the complex needs of these kids. So it's set up differently structurally, and there's a much better opportunity for services to operate more effectively there. So there's going to be a transition of the children who are currently in Parkville or Malmesbury into Cherry Creek over the back half of this year. And not too far down the track, Malmesbury is expected to close, and Parkville will continue to operate in a form. And I guess a little bit of time will take before we exactly know how these are going to be coordinated, the two arms of Parkville and Cherry Creek. But as I understand, the majority of young people in custody will be down at Cherry Creek in time.
And it is, or it is not, prison-like?
It's. I haven't visited it yet. I've seen pictures and the like of it, and it's certainly less prison-like. I mean, I guess we have to be clear here that any custodial environment is secure, and therefore it's got walls, so it's not an open site. Interestingly, Malmesbury, part of Malmesbury is an open site, and it's one of the few places for young people where there's a level of I guess you get some level of freedom in some ways. So their freedom and liberties are taken away from the perspective that they're structurally there's walls around it, but it's a much broader, it's a bigger space. As I understand, the units are set up very differently and much more appropriately for young kids, in that there's smaller numbers within the units, and we expect that will provide a much greater opportunity to actually do useful intervention with the kids.
As I understand it, presently in Victoria, we have only two lockdown secure mental illness beds for children between 10 and 18 in the whole of Victoria. Does Cherry Creek address that?
Partly. So just to explain, that there are two beds, and it's interesting to contrast that with the adult sector, that Thomas Embling Hospital has approximately 120 beds, so it's chalk and cheese in that regard. And it's something that has been a vexed issue for a long time in terms of what's the number of beds that we do require secure beds for young people. So that's where it's been for quite some time, 2 beds. As I understand, Cherry Creek will be having a therapeutic unit or units. Again, they haven't existed before. Just to explain that a little bit more depth, that young people who, or even adults who are in custodial environments, cannot be treated involuntarily. So the Mental Health Act cannot be utilised to treat a kid against their will whilst they're in custody. So these are therapeutic units that, you know, kids are obviously held against their will, but they are treated on a voluntary basis in terms of the intervention that's provided to them. If a child needs to be treated involuntarily, they will need to be moved out into one of those 2 beds. So there's some improvements there. Cherry Creek is offering more therapeutic interventions and beds to cater to that. And very similar to the adult prison system, that there is a large sectors of the prison system now that are deemed to be therapeutic. It's just that we can't treat people on an involuntary basis.
Out of your experiences of working with youth justice institutions such as Malmesbury, Parksville, etc., you've set up the Alfred Health Youth Forensic Specialist Service. What does the service do that's not being provided elsewhere?
So it's the start of what we're hoping is a far more expanded service. So it's a consultation service. So we provide primary consultation, as in we meet the young person and their family and do an assessment directly of them, or we provide secondary consultation, which is usually to one or more of mental health services, so kids who are intersecting with mental health services, child protection services, or youth justice itself. And it's a consultation service only, so we don't provide intervention. We provide an opinion and recommendations about what that child's needs are and how they can be best met by that service provider. And we're often providing quite a deal of support with what's described as care teams. So young people often have a raft of people that are assigned to their care, particularly those kids who are in the justice system or in child protection. And many kids are the crossover kids who are in both systems. And there's a lot of need for coordinated care of these kids, and we're often involved to provide the clinical oversight and I guess leadership in many ways to ensure that those kids' needs are met most satisfactorily.
So there is some light at the end of the tunnel, we hope.
We hope, yeah. There's still a lot of opportunity for growth, and there's still an enormous amount of unmet need. There's evidence now in the last few years, there's a rapid emergence and development of a range of sort of complex problems that we didn't necessarily see. I guess in that respect, there's a whole range of unmet needs that there's a lot of people sort of working their way through how we can cater to those needs, but it all comes down to money at the end of the day, and that we're hoping that the government can invest in this really needed area.
Lives in the Law is proudly sponsored by City Maps Illustrated. Their recent publication, The Melbourne Map, is a celebration of our wonderful city. This stunning, hand-drawn illustration, which took more than 3 years to create, is available as an art print, jigsaw puzzle, and calendar. The perfect acquisition for your home, office, or corporate gifting.
It seems to me to be outrageous, Adam, that the age of criminal responsibility in Victoria, and I think most of Australia, is 10 years of age, although our government is committed to raising it to 14 by the year 2027. But I believe on reading some of the things that you've said that it's not quite as simple as that. There's many issues to be considered and things to be weighed up to decide what's an appropriate age for criminal responsibility. No one would be better qualified than you to have an opinion on this. Could you share that opinion with us, please?
Sure. It's a complex area and it's quite divisive, I think. And I guess when the debate around raising the age was raised some years ago and ongoing in many ways, myself and many colleagues, in fact, all colleagues, I think, are more swayed towards raising the age and feeling like from a human rights perspective that it's not appropriate for young people to be deemed criminally responsible. It is far more complex than that. And I guess I've sort of learnt a lot over the last few years and doing a lot of assessments of children that the criteria that a child needs to meet is they didn't understand what they were doing was seriously wrong to be found criminally responsible. If we raise the age, that there might be some benefits that come from that to steer kids away from the justice system and arguably that can only be beneficial. But it doesn't stop young kids offending. It just means that they can't be found culpable for it. And where the gap lies as it stands at the moment, and there's a lot of work that's going to be done, I think, to try and address this, is for those children who don't understand or didn't understand what they were doing was wrong to the standards that matches criminal responsibility, what's the service response we need to be providing for them to ensure that they don't reoffend and that they learn that what they have done and what they may choose to do in the future is wrong, and so they can combat that behaviour. So there's still a lot to work through that I think in principle it's a good move, but there still needs to be a secondary response that caters to these children. And we're seeing more young kids engaging in quite serious behaviours objectively. And if they're not criminally responsible, what's our duty of care to them to ensure and to protect the community in many ways from them doing any harm to themselves and others?
So, Adam, would I be right in thinking that if it can't be just as simple as raising the age to 14, can it, Adam? There must be other things we need to do, or the system needs to be changed to have some effect upon those children and help them not to reoffend or to reduce the chances of them reoffending.
Yes, that's right, Michael. The core issue here really relates to the young child's moral development. The legislation as it stands relates to whether a child understands something is seriously wrong. If we think of a crime that is seriously wrong in the eyes of at least sort of mature, learned adults, a la a kid who commits a serious assault, if a child doesn't understand that's seriously wrong, the question is why, or should be why. Why don't they not understand? And the kids that we see, the bias is towards kids who have come from significant disadvantage, and there's a whole lot of influences that have shaped their moral development and skewed it in the wrong direction. So they haven't maturated in a direction that we would deem to be appropriate. There's a gap here that we need to sort of identify and cater to, that being if a child's moral development has been hindered, what can we do and what are our obligations for that child to enhance their moral development? And so they do understand things are wrong, and so they are less likely to commit those crimes again. Now, many of these kids come from such disadvantage, they don't have parents available to them. Their parents may be deceased, their parents may be in custody, their parents may have serious mental health issues. Many of them are in state care. So they don't have parents around them necessarily to provide the opportunities for them to learn as most kids do. So that's one of the gaps. And I guess one of the things we need to sort of work through is if there needs to be a service response, but who's to provide that? It won't be a justice response. Is it going to fall into the hands of child protection? And they may be equipped to cater to some of this, but then if it's not, then does there need to be a initiative for a sort of a tailored service response to these particular children?
A big hypothetical for you, Adam. Let's assume you're premier for a day and you can make any change you want to make, regardless of cost. What changes would you make to our criminal justice system?
Well, my interest obviously is in youth justice particularly, and my experience is that the vast majority of kids who interface with the justice system have such complex backgrounds, we have to have a far more sophisticated and tailored response to all of them in many respects. And I think a justice response is necessary to some extent, but it's not enough. And that really I think we need to create a system that has a very strong focus on education and health, and turn it more around towards being a health education response rather than a justice response as it stands right now. Now, hopefully Cherry Creek provides some opportunity to sort of start turning the dial in that direction. But if I was a premier for the day and had endless buckets of money, the staff that work with these kids would be those people who come from a variety of backgrounds, but potentially health, education, but life experience that can understand these kids, can empathise with them and work at the level that's required. So they feel safe, they feel secure, they feel trusted and respected, so you can actually work with them. But I think if it's in an environment that is harsh and austere and it feels like a prison, kids just won't respond as effectively as the alternative.
Are there any jurisdictions around the world who have such a system?
Certainly there is examples, and I haven't visited them. It's something on my bucket list to explore. But as I understand, in Portugal and some of the Scandinavian nations, there's been a far more, I guess, progressive approach, and they have adopted a more of an educational focus. As I understand, there is a facility in Portugal that is run by teachers, for example, a youth justice equivalent type facility that's run by teachers. And I know that a lot of the Scandinavian nations have been far more progressive in the way they have set up their establishments and the settings are so critical, and the staff relationships that are fostered with the clients themselves. It just engenders a much more therapeutic opportunity that arguably is just not afforded by the current prison system.
So looking ahead and listening to what you've said and what you do, are you optimistic that we will, or we are at least heading in the right direction?
Yeah, I am. Look, I think you have to be a little bit optimistic to do this work. You've got to be a bit of a bucket half full person, I think. If you're cynical or you're pessimistic, you're probably better off to do something else. I mean, it's a hard environment to work in, and there's incredible complexity, and you can be disheartened and sometimes very disillusioned and disappointed. But if you succumb to that, you may as well move on to somewhere else. And look, there are opportunities that are in front of us. There's some wonderful people working in this space who are very invested. We just need to have more investment, I think, into the aspects that I've just mentioned earlier to give this a chance, really. So my spirits are still up, but that's just who I am.
Well, getting to this point about who you are, how do you keep yourself up as a person who works in traumatic situations and has for the last 20-odd years or whatever? How do you keep yourself up? How do you keep yourself mentally and physically healthy?
It's a good question. It's an important one too. I mean, some of it's really the basics that we tend not to focus on, and I certainly don't do this perfectly by any means. But sleep is critical, making sure we get good sleep. I've become more alert to that and more focused on getting enough sleep and quality sleep. I exercise every day. It's always been part of my routine. I feel that I feel better. I operate better when I exercise, so I always prioritize that for at least an hour a day, do something just so I feel physically fit but mentally fit. And then I guess it's very much around the supports that you have around you or you establish around you. It's important to have really supportive peers, and I'm fortunate enough to have good groups of people that I link up with. I deliberately work in teams so we can share our experiences and support each other. And then doing other things is important, to be able to sort of disconnect completely and do other things that takes you completely away. And whether that be the daily routine of exercise or other activities, or investing in other community activities and volunteering, going on holidays, all the things that we need to do that sometimes we don't focus on. So I guess it's just trying to get that blend operating as a sort of a continuum, really, and making sure that you don't ignore the benefits of those things, because we can easily sort of fall into bad habits. And I guess I try to make sure I'm in good habits.
Adam, thank you very much for coming in today and giving us an insight into your life in the law, which is a different life in the law than the ones people we normally talk to, lawyers. But it's so important, the area you work in, and for us to know more about it. And hopefully all of us in our own ways can try to advocate to some extent about improving the system, particularly for children. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Michael. Thank you.
Show notes from today's episode can be found at greenslist.com.au/podcast. There you'll find links to things we've talked about in this episode, a transcript of the show, and some wonderful photos of our guests. If you're enjoying Lives in the Law, please tell your networks, subscribe, rate, and review the show. Your host is former lawyer and Greens List clerk, Michael Green. Our show is produced and edited by me, Catherine Green, mixed and mastered by Windmill Audio, and recorded by Alex McFarlane, who also wrote and performed all the music for the series. We're coming to you from the iconic Owen Dixon Chambers on the corner of William and Lonsdale Streets in our beautiful city of Melbourne. We acknowledge the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation as the traditional custodians of this land and pay our respect to their elders past and present. There is no doubt that conversations about justice have been taking place on this land for thousands of years, and we are privileged to continue that discussion here today.